Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Irene Skoranek.
And we are really fortunate to have Dr. Skoranek on our show today. Dr. Skoranek is a psychologist and head of behavioral health at the UNC Department of Family Medicine, and it's great to have you as a co-host while Dr. Page is and Christy is on vacation, Irene.
I am so glad to be here.
And on our show today, we also are going to be talking with Dr. Alex Smith, assistant professor in geriatrics at the University of Southern California's San Francisco, about a recent article he had in the New England Journal of Medicine about uncertainty. Isn't all of medicine certain, Irene?
I wish it were sometimes as a patient.
Well, even as doctors, we wish it was more certain, but we're going to be able to really explore that. But first, we've got some really interesting research that matters. We're going to be talking about exercise and prostate issues,
obesity and the perspectives of patients of different cultures,
about Facebook and its relationship to mood. Does it make it better or worse?
And how camping can reset your body clock.
Well, Irene, let's jump right into our very first research that matters. This is an article about exercise and prostate and one of the most common conditions affecting men called BPH, or benign prostatic hypertrophy. What's this article about?
Well, this article says that exercise helps. And one thing that one of the doctors involved in this work from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston said is that anything that is heart healthy is prostate healthy. And I think it's great news that exercise helps one more health condition.
Well, and this is really interesting because Christy and I oftentimes talk about on the show about, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, how little there seems to be available to help men who've got prostate conditions. We talk about prostate cancer. And with prostatic hypertrophy, while there are medications that are there, the medications have side effects. And so, you know, as a man that's probably approaching that time of his life where eventually I'll probably get BPH, and I don't even know if it's so benign, it's really interesting to think how exercise could help.
And what I like is that it's not just vigorous exercise. They found that low to moderate intensity physical activity, even having a physically active job, is beneficial to your prostate.
And this research, while it was not new, we thought it was an important amount of research because it suggests that perhaps we can counsel men, and men who have BPH may want to talk with their doctors about it, and that those who are in physically inactive jobs probably need to be more physically active because this is another way of really having a great benefit with very few side effects. Let's talk about our next research that matters, Irene, about obesity, and is it different maybe depending on one's ethnicity or background?
Well, this is a really interesting article that comes out of the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine about the perceptions of African-American and white women's, their perception of how their doctors talk to them about weight management and the role of weight management in their lives.
Yeah, I was really shocked. And this is what's called a qualitative research study. Instead of, you know, interviewing hundreds, if not thousands, of women and giving them a questionnaire, they did in-depth interviews one-on-one with 33 moderately to severe obese white and African-American women and wanted to understand, do they see their weight issues differently and do they have different perceptions of whether they want to receive treatment? What do they find?
Well, so what they found is that they perceive themselves differently. This paper found that white women were more frequently expressing depression and self-deprecation about their weight, whereas African—
Wait. Self-deprecation, what does that mean?
They felt bad about themselves because of their weight.
Huh, okay, that makes sense.
And African-American women described pride and positive body image. And
so they perceived their obesity very differently depending on one's background. What I mean, you, as a psychologist, how do you explain that?
Well, I think there's cultural differences to how we understand ourselves and our world, and we have different role models. I think what's really interesting here, though, is that they want the same things from their doctors.
So they both wanted equally to be receive treatment. They wanted their doctors to talk with them about ways of losing weight, and they both felt that weight loss would improve their health, I guess.
Right, and they both wanted the conversations to come from a doctor who expressed empathy, compassion, and took a non-judgmental, respectful attitude.
Yeah, I find this interesting. And one of the take-home messages for me is that I shouldn't make assumptions about what being overweight means to someone. Someone may be very happy with their weight, even if as a physician, I feel that their health might be improved by losing weight. Maybe I should ask first, how do you feel about your weight? And that might be a starting place.
Mm-hmm. For the beginning of a conversation, absolutely.
Well, I think we're going to hear more about this and certainly be more sensitive. And speaking of sensitivity, this next research, we're going to jump from the frying pan into the fire here. This is about Facebook and health or mental health, even I guess physical health. Tell us a little bit about this particular study, Irene.
So this study came out of work from some social psychologists at the University of Michigan, and they found that going on Facebook made people unhappy in a moment-to-moment way.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, I would say I am a mild to moderate Facebook user. What we can disclose here. Do you use Facebook, Irene?
I do use Facebook. I think that mild to moderate with sometimes a little more than I intend to.
Yeah, I'm not an excessive Facebook user because I can go several days, a week or two sometimes without using it. But for me, I find that I enjoy keeping up with people who I would otherwise have a very difficult time keeping up with and enjoy seeing the things that they put up there. So for me, I find Facebook usually to be an enjoyable experience. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I feel that way. I actually am doing a little self-change project on Facebook this year, 2013. I've been keeping a daily photo gratitude journal on Facebook.
Ooh.
Where each day I post one picture of something I'm grateful for. A lot of them are my dog.
Well, we're going to have to maybe post a picture of that dog on the Your Health
side.
Absolutely. And maybe one of Irene's gratitude factors here. And I wonder in this particular study, which by the way was in a journal called PLOS One, here about, you know, how is it that they found that the more that people were spending time on Facebook, the less happy they were? And they followed 82 college-age volunteers who answered questionnaires 5 times a day for 2 weeks and rated their well-being at the beginning and at the end. I'm kind of curious, what did they, you know, how did this study maybe reach conclusions that are maybe different than our experiences?
It's interesting. So one of the things they talk about in the discussion in this article is that there's a lot of mixed findings on Facebook. Some studies of Facebook find that it helps self-image. This study found it had a negative impact on mood. And they don't really understand yet, we don't understand yet why or how Facebook is impacting us.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny, but we were talking about before the show, Irene, about which of our Facebook posts gets the most attention, and we know that a picture of a ultrasound of a pregnant baby, or a picture of a child, or a wedding picture, those sorts of things get lots of attention. And I wonder though if it's the other posts though that get little attention that maybe this is about.
Right. Or if you're not having those important life events and you're seeing other people get those comments, it could have the same impact of sort of, I wish that were me.
Well, our very last research that matters real quickly is about camping and resetting our body clocks. And this was a really interesting article in the journal Current Biology about taking people out camping to see whether or not this changed their sleep.
And it certainly did. It was only 8 people on this week-long camping trip. They were exposed to nothing but natural light, and their sleep improved in just 1 week. They were getting up at about the same time. They were falling asleep and waking up 1 hour earlier than when they were not camping.
Well, with that prescription, we're going to take a break. That'll conclude the research that matters. But when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Alex Smith, assistant professor in geriatrics at the University of Southern California, San Francisco, about his article in the New England Journal of Medicine, Uncertainty, the Other Side of Prognosis. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skowronek. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoranek. Today on Conversations, Irene, we're going to be talking with Dr. Alex Smith, Assistant Professor in Geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, about a really fascinating article in the New England Journal of Medicine that he wrote recently about uncertainty, the other side of prognosis, or uncertainty in medicine. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Smith. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And I guess one of the first things that we might like to ask you is, what got you interested in writing an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about uncertainty? Did you just wake up one morning and say, I'm feeling uncertain?
I don't think so. We've been interested in the issue of prognosis for several years, and only recently have we come to realize that we've been focusing almost exclusively on trying to identify and build better prognostic models.
And when you say prognosis, help our listeners understand what you mean by that term as compared to another common term that most people know, like diagnosis.
Great. So prognosis means the expected outcome or the probable outcome of a disease or condition. So, for example, life expectancy is one form of prognosis that listeners are probably most familiar with. In other words, the answer to the question, how long do I have, doctor? But prognosis can be about more than life expectancy. It could be about things like how long until I enter a nursing home, or how long until I become disabled and can't live without the support of somebody else. So there are many types of prognosis, and my work is in geriatrics and palliative care, and so clinically, I'm seeing patients who are grappling with how long they have every time that I'm on service. We've done some work early on about trying to figure out what tools are available for clinicians to estimate prognosis for older adults, and we published this systematic review in JAMA so that clinicians could evaluate what prognostic tools are available so they could engage patients in decision-making based on how long they might have to live. And then we converted those tools into a website called ePrognosis, which is available online, free for anybody to use.
And so is that for doctors or for patients?
We designed it for doctors. And then we had a lot of, and we actually had this you had to click a button that said, I am a healthcare professional. If you didn't click that, then you weren't allowed to proceed. But we found, so this website and article blew up, and it was in the New York Times, it was in USA Today, it was in the Daily Beast. We had 500,000 hits in our first week. And a lot of the feedback we got from users, that people wanted to put their parents in there. And they felt discomforted because they felt they had to lie and say they were a health professional to proceed. So we eventually decided to allow anybody to use the site.
That's really interesting, because as soon as I read this article, I sent it to my mom, who happens to be a physician. But mm-hmm. these are the kinds of issues we talk about our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because, you know, yes, it's what the insurance agents use a lot of times to, you know, make these models for how long, you know, and how costly it is going to provide care. But how well can we actually do this? Because it seems to me really one of the thrust of your articles is there's so much uncertainty about giving prognosis.
Yep, exactly. So what we realized is we created this web tool that was, you know, well used. A lot of geriatricians around the country and even and primary care docs are using this tool, but we hadn't focused on the conversation side of it. And we felt that the science of building prognostic models had really outpaced the art of communication with patients about prognosis. And one of the key element of that communication is uncertainty. Because I think, you know, even our task as clinicians is really focused on helping patients manage uncertainty.
Can you give us an example of that illustrates what you mean by the science outpacing the art and the communication challenge?
So I think if you look in the literature about prognosis, you'll see in their systematic review, we reviewed thousands of articles. So there are people who are trying to develop prognostic models using this marker, that biomarker, this physical measure, this question, that question. But there are, you know, maybe a handful of articles about how to actually discuss prognosis and discuss the uncertainty inherent in prognosis with patients.
So if you have a diagnosis of, let's say, heart failure, advanced heart failure, that many would say is kind of like a diagnosis of cancer in terms of life expectancy, how do you talk about a very shortened potential life expectancy with someone based on that diagnosis?
Yes. I think that's one example. And most examples of these prognosis discussions focus around short-term life expectancy. And I think that's where clinicians in general are reluctant to discuss prognosis. And part of the reason is that it's uncertain. But they're most comfortable discussing short-term prognosis for patients with advanced diseases, for example, like heart failure, as you just mentioned, Adam. However, prognosis is really important for long-term decisions, especially in older adults. For example, cancer screening, something primary care docs are involved with every day in the clinic with patients. But cancer screening only makes sense if your patient is going to live long enough to benefit from detecting a slow-growing cancer that was likely to cause symptoms or harm them over the course of about 10 years. If they're not going to live that long, then they're exposed to all the harms and risks of cancer screening, including things like false positives, treatment for a disease that wouldn't have hurt them or wouldn't have killed them. And those are all experienced up front, right?
So how would you talk differently to a patient when you're trying to keep in mind uncertainty and this other side of prognosis? How would that change how you talk to a patient?
So I think that we have to... So I think that some doctors use uncertainty as an out to avoid these conversations. They say, we just can't know for sure, and so they drop it. But I don't think that's true. I think we have information, but the information has limits, and we have to acknowledge those limits of that information with patients. Like, I wish we could be more certain, but like the weather, we can't be absolutely certain. We can only tell you the best information we have at this time.
You mean like if someone has a diagnosis of, let's say, pancreatic cancer, which we know will kill most of those people within a year to 15 months, but we don't know whether this particular patient's going to live 6 months or 15 months.
That's right, right.
And so what do you say? Help us.
So I always like to give ranges. And that gives a sense of the uncertainty. I'll often start out, because I like to be, colloquial with patients, I'll say, look, are you interested in how much time you may have left? And I like to invite that because some patients aren't interested in that information. So I offer to discuss prognosis. And then I say, if they're interested, I say, look, I could pick a date, but I can guarantee I would be wrong. So that gives them a warning shot that the information I'm about to give them is uncertain. And then I give them an estimate with a range. And I say, but based on other patients we've seen with conditions similar to yours, I'd be concerned that you probably have somewhere between 6 months, year and a half left to live. Most people living less than a year. And then I wait a second to let that information sit in. Because most doctors jump immediately to reassurance with their patients. But that kind of makes patients worry.
Well, I'm going to break that rule and have to jump right in just for a second because we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Smith, about his article in the New England Journal of Medicine about uncertainty in medicine and prognosis. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoranek.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoranek. We've been talking with Dr. Alex Smith today about uncertainty in medicine. We've had a really interesting conversation so far about the challenges of uncertainty and wanting to tell patients a prognosis, a prediction of the future, and how incredibly challenging that is. And in your article, Dr. Smith, you mention talking to patients about the emotions that come with uncertainty. And so one of the things I do in my job at UNC Family Medicine is help resident physicians learn how to talk to patients. And I'm really excited to hear your thoughts on sort of the best way to talk to patients about the emotions they're having about the uncertainty that you're describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, uncertainty about the future can be terrifying. I think we send a lot of mixed messages to patients with all of the credible advances in medicine. And one of the messages we seem to send to them is that we can know for certain what happens in the future, and that's simply not the case. And we as doctors need to recognize that an uncertain future can be frightening to patients, and that if we and we need to attend to those emotions associated with that. People make sports. So why should we attend to those emotions? I think, one, it's our responsibility to react and help patients process the affective response to prognostic information. And that, two, patients tend to make poor decisions when they're anxious or experiencing strong emotions. And so that if we can help patients to refocus from an uncertain future that might be terrifying to a present and living with the patient in the present or living as the patient in the present, and making each day as good as it can be in the present moment, then we're helping patients not only live better in the here and now, but also make better decisions about their care going forward.
So let's take an example of something that is near and dear to virtually all of us if involved in medicine and with family members, which is Alzheimer's because of its frequency in the population. How does the advice that you're just giving help us when a family member and a loved one is getting a diagnosis of Alzheimer's?
Mm-hmm. Well, Alzheimer's is a frightening disease. And for persons who have a family history of Alzheimer's, they may feel like they're living under the threat of developing this condition. And I think what we see in the news is that there are these incredible advances in how to detect Alzheimer's, but we also see in the news that we're not doing well as far as making advances in how to treat the disease. And my own perspective is that I worry about people seeking out tests for a condition for which there is no treatment. On the other hand, I can understand people wanting to know their prognosis just for the sake of knowing what the future might bring.
So for someone who's just been given a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, again, help us, walk us through, how does that here and now work? How do you refocus? Because the fear is that we're going to end up not knowing a single person around us and not able to care for ourselves in any potential way.
Mm-hmm. No, I recently read a blog. There's a blog, and I'm not going to say this person's name right. He's a family practice doc who was in the Midwest and then moved to D.C. And he developed early Alzheimer's, and he's writing about it online.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the incredible things about his writing is that he's viewing this as an opportunity. And I've read this elsewhere that as well, that there may be opportunity in the present, and that the future is so concerning that we have to refocus on the present, and that there may be a stripping away of incidental daily things that would otherwise burden us, and instead we may refocus on issues that are more important, relationships.
It's such an exciting perspective. I think so often patients go to doctors wanting answers, sort of, what is my prognosis? And to sort of reframe that doctors are a place to go where you can get uncertainty normalized and you can have talk about emotions and think about living mindfully in the present is sort of a new and really important role for physicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is. I think it's part and parcel of what palliative care is about, and that this is an influence that palliative care can have on the rest of medicine. I think a lot of people think palliative care is about death and dying, but I think of palliative care is about living and making a choice to live each day as good as it can be, and working with patients in order to do that. And I'm hopeful that every clinician should be able to engage in these sorts of conversations. Because
so,
people know, whether you're an ophthalmologist and you're giving bad news, you're always going to be talking with people and dealing with difficult conversations.
You know, we have what's called placebos in medicine, right? When we can give someone a shot, and it can be a sugar pill, and sometimes we know that the thought of something's going to help you, and it helps you. And I know there are some who believe that the words themselves can be placebos, the words, if they help people feel better. And the opposite is nocebos, if we say words that hurt people. Is what you're saying that these conversations about uncertainty, the conversations themselves can be healing or conversely unhealing?
That's an interesting perspective. So there was an article in the New England Journal came out last year, maybe the year before, about patients who have advanced cancer, and whether their oncologist, whether they have an understanding that the chemotherapy they're being treated with is of curative intent or not of curative intent. And these patients had cancers that would certainly die from in a matter of months to years. And the chemotherapy was purely to treat symptoms. And those who thought that the chemotherapy was curative were more satisfied with their doctors. And that's kind of a warning shot. It's what you're talking about, Adam, that these conversations might be uncomfortable for some patients because you're talking about prognosis and life expectancy and that realistic expectations of treatment. On the other hand, I think what we can do, help patients to prepare, and that satisfaction might be the wrong metric. And the better metric might be how well prepared did you feel to deal with these, to deal with what happened to you when the difficult choices needed to be made? So that, we, as doctors, we do uncomfortable things to our patients all the time. And that's part of our job. And I think we have uncomfortable conversations with patients. But we can also, it's also part of our job to help them refocus on living in the here and now and making each day in the present moment as good as it can be and not dwelling on a future that might be terrifying.
Well, I think we need to thank you, Dr. Smith, for opening the door to help these conversations occur. We really appreciate you making yourself available to Your Health listeners.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this interview.
We've been talking with Dr. Alex Smith, University of California, San Francisco, about his article in the New England Journal of Medicine about uncertainty, the other side of prognosis. We'll be certain to put information about his blog and his information that he's had in the Journal of the American Medical Association, other tools that people might be interested in as a link to our website. Again, thank you very much. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Irene Skoronek. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Irene, we're going to spend a few minutes taking our health questions and concerns, but that was just a fascinating conversation we just had with Dr. Smith.
I really loved talking to him, and I loved reading his article. I found out a couple days ago that my dog has heartworms, and I spent a lot of the last few days reading online and trying to find some prognosis and certainty about what will happen. And rereading his article just before we talked to him and talking to him was incredibly freeing for me to know that I can accept the uncertainty and live in the moment with my dog, which is a lovely moment to be in with her.
And how's she doing?
She's doing well. She started some medication and there's going to be a few more months of it. And I think she's going to be okay. We're going to love her and support her. And support her and her negative emotions and ours.
Well, we appreciate you sharing that, and we really do wish you and her, what's her name?
Toffee.
We recommend Toffee all the best.
Thank you.
And we also have some really interesting house calls today, and we've got a house call about someone who has problems with urination, particularly when they exercise. About someone, a woman who, a question about eye makeup and pink eye.
A question about whether or not you can drink too much water.
And finally, a rash during pregnancy. Well, let's just dive in and ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call.
Is it normal to sometimes urinate a bit when I laugh or exercise?
Well, that's an interesting question that is one that I think many of us don't think about, but I bet is something that's really pretty common.
Certainly as people get older.
Yeah, you know, it's, and maybe even, you know, younger, I imagine that, and I know that the ligaments of the lower uterine segment around the uterus and around the bladder, certainly with pregnancy and having children and abdominal surgeries for women, and then for men, that condition we called benign prostatic hypertrophy. Again, it's not really benign, but laughter can cause increased pressure on the lower abdomen and the bladder and the uterus and the pelvis, and all those things can cause leakage. You know, Irene, I don't know if in when you are working with a residence in our family medicine clinic and a patient were to bring this type of condition up, what's the type of advice that you sometimes would give to the residents about how to hear this concern? Because it's one that isn't funny, it's really serious.
Right. I think to listen and be really mindful as you listen and then to normalize, because this is
what
something.
Do you mean? What do you mean normalize?
I mean, remind the patient that this is something that happens to a lot of people in different situations, and it's a really good thing to ask your doctor about and check in about. So to sort of encourage them to be open and share.
Yeah, and I think that's a key, that it happens, and it may happen to a lot of doctors, you know. It's not like that doctors would be immune by any stress, any stress of the imagination from this, and even, you know, in exercise as well. And there are things to be done. There, I don't know if anyone's ever tried to explain, everyone's heard the word Kegel exercises, and these exercises to strengthen the pelvis floor and the bladder. These are ones I actually tell men and women about.
Well, in that article about prostate health, it recommended Kegels for men, even though we do often think of them as something that women can do.
Well, let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
Do women need to replace all of their eye makeup and brushes after pink eye?
Well, I'm going to rely a little bit on Irene here, because I don't use makeup and brushes on my eyes. But I do know that medically speaking, the infection that can come from the eyes of conjunctivitis, which is what pink eye is, which is frequently a virus, I think most doctors would say you should throw these things away. But that could be expensive, can't it?
I think it can. I'll be honest, I don't wear much eye makeup either. And I think it might depend on which part of the eye. If it's eyeliner and it's going right close to your eye, it'd be more important to replace it than if it's an eyeshadow going on the lid.
And there are all these conditions called blepharitis, which is inflammation of the eyelid. We don't usually call that pink pink eye. But I guess if you had that blepharitis or inflammation of the eyelid, then even the eyeshadow could be a problem. So I guess one of the questions is to, you know, ask your doctor, be specific, because they may use, oh, pink eye, and it might mean different things to different people. Where is that infection? I think that's a really good idea, Irene. Well, let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
Can you drink too much water?
Well, how much water do we really drink? Are you a big water drinker, Irene?
I drink a lot of water. If you notice, I'll always have a water bottle with me. I'm filling it frequently, and I frequently make bathroom breaks.
Well, you know, and it's really interesting because a lot of patients do drink a lot of water, because we've given messages out, I think, in medicine over the years, you know, that you do need to drink water. You need to drink. And one of the first things that I sometimes notice for patients who have problems urinating a lot at night is they drink a lot of water during the day. And so we have to have this conversation about, well, how much is too much? What do you think is a kind of a common sense thing, Irene?
Well, I'll say I did just take a sip of water as this conversation came up. Well, as a non-physician, I think that drinking enough so that you're quenching your thirst and you're not spending all day in the bathroom and you have clear urine, is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And those are just common sense ways of understanding. I think that's what we as physicians would oftentimes recommend is, you know, moderation here. Can you drink too much water? Yes. I was a physician volunteering in Buenos Aires on New Year's Eve, like 6 or 7 years ago, and we found an elite athlete. He was playing in the Pan American Maccabi Jewish Olympic Games, and he was a basketball player, and he started having seizures. And we went and got him emergency rushed through a hospital through the streets of Buenos Aires. His fireworks were going off, and his serum sodium level was dramatically low, life-threatening low. And it turned out it had been so hot. It was summer down there. He'd been drinking so much water, and that drinking so much water had driven his serum sodium down so low. And so some people do drink too much water, either because they think they have to, or because sometimes maybe psychologically they are maybe on medicines in which they drink so much. Most people, that's probably not going to happen. Well, let's listen to our very last house call, Erica.
I'm 20 weeks pregnant, and I recently got a small dot on my forehead. A doctor friend of mine said not to worry about it because pregnant women get these frequently, but it's ugly and I don't like it. Will it go away?
I think in most cases, a small red dot on the forehead is something called a hemangioma. It's a fancy term for a small red blood vessel, a small red dot. And we see these much more frequently in newborn children, but also in pregnant women when the blood vessels expand because pregnant woman is adding on weight and volume, in this case, water, and their blood vessels are expanding. These things aren't worrisome, and they can be treated. You can zap them with electrical current. You can't zap it yourself. Don't do this at home. But you can go to your doctor, and your doctor can do this, either your family doctor or primary care doctor or dermatologist, plastic surgeon. They are treatable, but they're not harmful. Well, that'll conclude the research, the house call segment of our show today. And we hope we've addressed some issues important to you and your health. We've had a chance to talk about laughter and excess urination, about eye makeup, and perhaps needing to find out where on the eye this occurs.
And whether or not you can drink too much water, and skin conditions in pregnancy.
So if you have your own questions you'd like us to address, please send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Alex Smith. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Irene Skoranek.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heels station.